Well, I'm very pleased to see so many people coming to a course on Wittgenstein's philosophy. Back in the 60s, there were three or four following the lectures. But things have expanded quite a lot. So it is nice to see all of you here, and I hope it will be possible for you to follow what I am going to present to you, because I will more or less read to you a kind of article, part of a controversy in the 80s with Baker and Hacker. They are the large looming fellows in Wittgenstein research, at least in the 80s and the 90s, etc., and a guy from Bergen protests against their understanding of some parts of rule following, and especially the practice aspect of it. But Bergen has been a very special place for Wittgenstein and Wittgenstein research, because my professor, Knut Erik Trane, he is still with us, but he has a bit trouble with hearing. He was a student in Cambridge from 49 to 51. And his very good friend was Georg Henrik von Wright. Georg Henrik von Wright was one of Wittgenstein's most closest pupils. And von Wright placed Knut Erik Trane in the very same house as Wittgenstein. So my professor could tell a lot of stories about this strange fellow, who liked to talk to him because he didn't pretend to be a philosopher. He was just beginning his philosophy studies at that time. If he was an ordinary philosopher, Wittgenstein probably would not have talked to him. Well, we were told a lot of interesting stories, which I shall not recount here on this occasion, but from the very first semester in my studies here, I had the professor who was keen on Wittgenstein, and a lecturer, university lecturer, who was really hooked on Wittgenstein. Every semester he started a new series on Wittgenstein's philosophical investigations, and we always started at paragraph one. And we never succeeded to reach beyond paragraph 7. So he was trying to do what Wittgenstein is said to have done, sitting on a chair and producing philosophy. Well, the interpretation of Wittgenstein's later philosophy has undergone a series of changes since his book Philosophical Investigations was first published in 1953. In the beginning, it was said that Wittgenstein's later philosophy was all about the idea of meaning is use. That's the big thing. The reviews written by Peter F. Strawson, Norman Malcolm, and Paul Feyerabend fostered this view, and Wittgenstein himself seemed to confirm it. In paragraph 43 in Philosophical Investigations, he in fact says something to this effect, even if it is stated in a careful and slightly hesitant way. His exact words are these. For a large class of cases, though not for all, in which we employ the word meaning, it can be explained thus. the meaning of a word is its use in language. End quote. In this quotation, one of Miss Anscombe's many mistranslations crops up. I'm sorry to say that the book you read in English, at least, has still today lots of strange, to put it mildly, translations from German. Well, this is one of them. She translates the German word erklären by the English word define, and it still says define in your books, which is simply wrong in this context. The German word normally means explain, as I have used here, and not define. The German and the Austrians and everybody else speaking German, they are quite capable of saying definieren when they mean to talk about the more formal aspects of the matter. Wittgenstein was, as we know, not happy about any kind of talk about definitions at all. And here he says expressly that his statement goes only for a large class of users, but not for all. A definition, as you probably know, on the other hand, is always conceived of as something that holds universally. This is more than sufficient to realize that Wittgenstein did not intend his statement as a definition. But a lot of confusion has arisen from this wrong-headed translation that Miss Anscombe once made. And she is the translator of the English version. Anyhow, the slogan, meaning is use, was central to the so-called ordinary language philosophy in the 50s and the 60s. Therefore, one was liable to read this slogan into Wittgenstein's text and thus make him an ordinary language philosophy, although a very special one. Some of the books and articles on Wittgenstein's later philosophy from the 50s and the 60s make a rather strange reading today. I have brought with me here the first very serious book-length treatment of Wittgenstein's philosophy. It is written by a philosopher called George Pitcher, and it was published in 1964. Notice that. It's 11 years since Philosophical Investigations were published, and the very first book comes in 64. The book is simply called The Philosophy of Wittgenstein. And here we meet a philosopher looking for particular philosophical themes and new arguments in Wittgenstein. We find very little about his method in philosophy. We look in vain for anything concerning logical grammar, and we are not capable of tracing anything having to do with following rules and being drilled in executing practices and how such themes may be related to Wittgenstein's understanding of the concept of meaning. Pitcher no doubt looked upon Wittgenstein's text from the point of view of ordinary language philosophy and discovered very little of what we today consider peculiar to Wittgenstein's way of thinking. Slowly, however, a more refined and complicated picture of Wittgenstein's thinking was revealed as more of his writings were published. And in the early 70s, a microfilm of his whole Nachlass was also made accessible. And the Norwegian departments of philosophy bought one of those, which was the background for the work at the Wittgenstein archive. Step by step, something which probably could be called the Wittgenstein tradition in philosophy became established. Because Wittgenstein is not to be considered an analytical philosophy of this or that kind. He represents his own tradition and nothing but that. And the analytical commentary commenced upon in 1980 by Gordon Baker and Peter Hecker was a significant step in the right direction. In the preface to the second volume, published in 1985, these two Wittgenstein researchers tell the reader that the work they had started in 1980 was much harder than they had assumed from the beginning. They expressed themselves and this concern in the following way. Quote, "When we returned to volume 2 and started the detailed work on paragraph 185 to 242, we found that the way down from the passes, far from being a smooth and gentle slope, was steep, rugged, and strewn with obstacles. The articulation of the text was difficult to fathom. The individual remarks were more problematic than anything we had hitherto tackled. The only safe recourse was to map the terrain by reference to the underlying writings in Wittgenstein's Nachlass, and then to trace his footsteps slowly and carefully, avoiding the pitfall of jumping to a conclusion on the basis of a single remark or sentence." Unquote. No doubt they did their best to make their comments as reliable as possible. That is worth remembering when I further on take Baker to task for not being sufficiently perceptive as concerns the concept of the practice. Still, I think they were on the right track when they, in the first volume, claimed that the paragraphs from 143 till 242 are to be considered the core of philosophical investigations. And in those paragraphs, it is all about rules and following rules and practices. They were, however, not the first to see Wittgenstein's masterpiece that way. Peter Winch, have you heard his name? He was a very famous English Wittgensteinian. When a young man, Peter Winch had already in 1958 in his small and very much discussed book The Idea of a Social Science made use of an interpretation of philosophical investigations which made rule following the central theme of it. And the concept of practice he also used in a rather, well, sloppy way we would say today, but it was the first attempt to make use of that idea. Anyhow, Peter Winch was clearly working his way towards the insight that there exists a mutually constitutive relationship between concept formation, human activities, and what the humans call reality. To learn to master a language is, in this perspective, not to learn the names of various things in the world. It is more like learning to master a huge repertoire of different activities and situations where use of language is involved in a very different but non-eliminable ways. It is to learn to master human reality in all its complexity. Some critics at that time, late 50s, early 60s, they objected to Winch's interpretation and argued that he had fallen victim to the idealistic fallacy of believing that language creates reality. There was a lot of talk about that at that time. That was, however, far off the mark. What Peter Winch had succeeded in showing was that it was only in the context of a practice that it is possible to identify, refer to, react upon, intervene in, investigate, come to terms with, reflect upon, grasp, and become familiar with the various aspects of human reality in a rule-governed manner, that is, in a meaningful way. This comes close to insisting that the manifold of practices is something like a condition for the possibility of giving meaning to anything at all. In his lapidary style, Wittgenstein sums up this in remarks on color, where he, near the end of that manuscript, simply says that, quote, practices give words their meaning. Now I will present to you an article which I wrote quite some time ago concerning this particular matter, the concept of practice and rule following and understanding the various aspects of these problems. In an article from 1972 called Wittgenstein and Certainty, George Henrik von Wright gives a sketch of the main themes of the manuscript on certainty, which has been published as a separate book. Commenting upon Wittgenstein's remarks concerning the fragments of a world picture underlying the manifold uses of language, he points out that the world picture, strictly speaking, has no propositional nature, since it is, according to Wittgenstein, quote, the inherited background against which I distinguish between true and false. Von Wright suggests instead that it would be more appropriate to talk about something he called Vorwissen, that is, pre-knowledge or foreknowledge in English. This foreknowledge has a most peculiar character, according to von Wright. It is best thought of as a kind of practice, or practices in plural. The choice of this particular expression is deliberate. It is meant to hint at the way Wittgenstein himself describes the basis of every language game. He says in Übergewissheit or uncertainty. Quote, it is our acting which lies at the bottom of the language games. End quote. At some crucial junctures, Wittgenstein actually uses this expression himself. We shall take a closer look at the relevant passages further on. For the moment, I would only like to mention that in these passages, he is mostly trying to make his reader realize the complexity of the interrelationships between our language and what we call our world. It is fairly well recognized that this is the problem that is fundamental to all of Wittgenstein's thinking. But until now, it has not been looked into with the concept of practice at the very center. In the following pages, I intend to do just that, taking my lead from Georg Henrik von Wright. To explicate the concept of practice in all its different ramifications is, of course, out of the question here. Still, I think it is a worthwhile undertaking to try to sketch some of the main ideas that, in my opinion, seem in an intriguing way to be connected to the concept of practice as it is used in discussing rule following and equally fundamental themes in Wittgenstein. Only a few of Wittgenstein's commentators at the time I wrote this have in fact taken the trouble to look into the role of this particular concept with an explicit exception which Baker and Hecker make up. As I see it, the concept of practice is primarily concerned with the activity aspect of the use of concepts and closely related ideas pertaining to concept formation, making sense. This is noted from time to time in random commentaries that are offered in explanation of the term practice, as it occurs in Wittgenstein's discussion of rule following. A case in point is Gordon Baker, and he expresses himself this way. Quote, the concept of measurement presupposes agreement in judgment. Regularities in behavior underpin the unity of this concept, since otherwise the wide range of independent criteria for making correct measurements would produce a random scatter of often conflicting applications of this concept in place of the coherent pattern actually observed. This point about regularity is what Wittgenstein meant to stress by calling measuring and, more generally, rule-following practices. This is the way he introduces the concept of practice. Baker emphasizes the undeniable and important connection between agreement in judgments and practice. And this seems to be all there is to the concept of practice on this interpretation. Practice is understood as a matter of sheer regularity in behavior underpinning the unity of our concepts. But in my opinion, this is a too narrow and not particularly fertile conception, as I will try to show in the sequel. For instance, the far more exciting aspects of formism, with its intriguing non-propositional character, is not recognized at all. It might therefore pay to investigate rather more carefully the use Wittgenstein actually makes of the concept of practice in his later philosophy. Since this concept is most definitely at work where the term practice is used, I shall have to look into the different occurrences of this term and their context in order to determine fairly clearly the meaning or the family of meanings that the term is given. It is, however, neither profitable nor feasible in this connection to cover all these occurrences. We can, after all, get a fairly good idea of what Wittgenstein is after if we delimit our scrutiny to the main contexts of his use. But what are the main uses? How do we decide that? Well, probably that decision can be made in many different ways. The method I suggest is to look at the concept of practice in the light of those concepts which it replaces in his thinking. Its centrality will then be easily recognized. This approach makes it necessary to take a glance at the development of Wittgenstein's thought, a very short one, that is. It is beyond doubt that the younger Wittgenstein was concerned with the question of how language can represent the world. His first solution to this problem is also very well known. Language was thought to represent the world by picturing it. And this picturing could take place because language and world had a common logical form. That was the Tractatus idea. Logic was thus the most fundamental element in the solution of the task he set himself. This solution further implied that logic became the limit of what could meaningfully be said. As such, it was itself inexpressible. In Tractatus, this was put by stating that, quote, logic must take care of itself. You know now very well that things went wrong in Tractatus, according to Wittgenstein. And when he returned to philosophy in 1929, he started a search for a better solution here. He no longer believed that logic had this remarkable role in our grasp of the world. Instead, he says in Philosophical Grammar that language, and this is a quote, language must speak for itself. Now it has become not logic, but language itself that has to take care of itself or speak for itself. But this was in the middle period, from 1929 to late 1936. And Wittgenstein had not yet realized how deeply intertwined language and action are. That is an insight that belongs to, well, the late mid-30s, if I could put it that way, 36, 37, then that comes up in his texts. As he came to see this close connection clearly, he was at first content to make it a salient feature of the concept of language game, undeniably traceable in the wording of paragraph 23 in Philosophical Investigations, because here he says, quote, "Here the term language game is meant to bring into prominence the fact that the speaking of language is part of an activity or form of life." Unquote. This is still a fairly early way of putting the point. This was written in late 1636 in Scholten, by the way. At the end of his life, he was working on two manuscripts, Remarks on Color and on Certainty. And I will make use of them as well, because I see a fairly close continuity between what Wittgenstein started late in 36 and the rest of his life. In On Certainty, he makes the remark that the practice has to speak for itself. And then you see we have three different ways of indicating something that is obviously considered to be very basic for Wittgenstein in his attempt to try to see how language and world and human beings go together. There is a rather striking similarity here between the three ways of expressing the idea of what has to go unexplained in the mediation between the language and the world. Remembering his fascination with Karl Kraus, a very famous Austrian in the beginning of the last century, and his insistence that the Tractatus is strictly philosophical and at the same time literary, I'm convinced that there is something far more significant in Wittgenstein's way of putting this idea than the sheer coincidence in a choice of expression. To me, the documented similarities in expression signifies the movement of his thought about how language and world are in fact interwoven through a huge manifold of interrelated practices. That is his last thought on the matter. If this interpretative sketch is accepted, at least as a guideline, where does that take us with respect to the main occurrences of the term practice in Wittgenstein's later philosophy? Well, the term crops up in Philosophical Investigations at the very heart of his analysis of rule following, and it is used repeatedly in Remarks on Color and on Certainty. It is used in several different but obviously interrelated senses, some of which are fairly close to what he usually talks of as language games. This is especially so when he reminds us that, quote, "There is always the danger of wanting to find an expression's meaning by contemplating the expression itself, instead of always thinking of the practice." but also when he remarks that, quote, theology fumbles around with words because it wants to say something and does not know how to express it. The practice gives words their meaning. There you have the context of that earlier quotation as well. Here we may easily imagine language game substituted for practice. That, however, is not so straightforwardly the case when we look at the context of the occurrence we just quoted, where practice is said to look after itself. Here, Wittgenstein reflects upon what it takes to establish a practice. Quote, not only rules, but also examples are needed for establishing a practice. Our rules have loopholes open, and the practice has to speak for itself. Once again. Unquote. If this occurrence of the term practice has the fundamental significance I have ascribed to it, it is not difficult to realize that the use of the term in paragraph 202 in Philosophical Investigations, where it is introduced, is of paramount importance. In this paragraph, rule following in general is said to be a practice. This is a kind of commentary on the preceding paragraph, and I shall return to that occurrence in a moment, and that is after the break. Well, in any case, I think I'm justified in saying that there is a sort of internal relationship between Wittgenstein's analysis of rule following and at least one of the senses of the term practice. We have to be careful here. As a parenthetical remark, I may mention that the occurrence of practice in Philosophical Inventions, paragraph 202, is not even listed in the index of my copy of Philosophical Investigations from 1967. That indicates how much one was interested in that particular expression at that time. But that has, of course, changed. And we are, after the break, going to look into some of those things. We meet in a quarter of an hour again.